This is a recording of D.H. from Greer, South Carolina, the Saturday night main speaker, taped at the LRCNA number 10 in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, on Saturday, May 23rd, 1992. Thank you.
I'm Billy, I'm an addict. I've been clean all day today in Narcotics Anonymous. I'm from Richmond, Virginia. Privileged to be able to introduce our speaker tonight. Met this guy in 1984. Cherokee Reservation at an NA function. He's one of those people that got clean about 7 months before I did. He's been an inspiration to me. He helped get meetings of Narcotics Anonymous started in North Carolina. Been very instrumental in Narcotics Anonymous for the past 12 years. I can't say enough about him because he's one of those people that I admire and respect in this thing called life and this program of Narcotics Anonymous. I'd like to just, with that, introduce D. H. from Greenville, South Carolina.
I'm not going to tell you what he said. I'm going to start off with something in Cherokee Indian, and it goes like this. Sio stayun agasawi. And what it means is, hello, how are you doing? And with that, I'm going to say, my name's Dan, I'm an addict. And I'm a reservation addict. I say that for two reasons. Is one, I'm from Cherokee Indian Reservation, Cherokee, North Carolina, originally. And two is for many, many years, I had a lot of reservations about recovery. After coming into the program, I went back to the reservation one day. I was having a hard time, almost got loaded, and read in the book, there are no reservations in recovery, so I left. You know, and I feel like that's God, as I understand God, working in my life. You know, I get the message when I need it, and that's what it's all about. And that's why I'm here tonight. So, I don't know, I get a little nervous when something that looks like a phallic symbol is sticking in my face. I mean, it's like, you know, this microphone here or whatever. Am I talking in the wrong one? Was that what it is? I had two pointing at me, and I couldn't make my mind up here. So, can you hear me in the back? Okay, I'll talk lower. I don't want y'all to hear me. You look like a rough crowd back there. So. Just kidding. Yeah. 16 years I spent proving that I had a problem. Actually, my using started early in life. As a child, I cried for Paragork. For those of you who are not quite old enough to know what Paragork is about, have some of the older folks in here explain it to you. I'm sure they can do a better job than I. I wasn't old enough at that time to analyze it, just to take it, you know. And my mother, I used to have a lot of upset stomachs. I got an upset stomach tonight. This is, I swear to God, do y'all eat anything that you don't pour that damn hot sauce on? I found it in my, I started to say patient packet. That's what I felt. I found it in my packet when I come in. I thought, well, they'd give me something to drink. You know? We were in the room, and I was kind of boasting. I was telling Al. Al's this guy's sponsor that wrote in with me. And I said, Al, you know, I used to win bets by drinking this stuff by the bottle. And so I had to do a little miniature demonstration there, you know. And I drank it, and the next morning, woo. I mean, when I woke up, you talk about not being able to save your face and your ass at the same time. I mean, I was in the bathroom sitting on the John, having a conscious contact that you would not believe. At the top of my lungs. You have to all have to overlook me. I'm one of those, and I think the last night's speaker kind of touched on a little bit. I'm one of those people who was, believe it or not, a Baptist minister. I was involved in ministry prior to coming in the program. And you talk about some sick people. Now, I've had a lot to overcome when I got here dealing with some of the things in the program and rearranging my thinking. But I thank God today for what brought me here. And the day prior to getting to this program, you know, I used, let me step back. I used, you know, the first real high that I remember was at 9 years old when I got drunk, you know, with some of the other people on the res, as we call it. And had a little blackout. Everybody told me I had a good time because I couldn't remember what happened. And by the time I was 13, you know, I knew at that very first experience, though, that something was wrong. I don't know about anybody else in this room, but I knew the first time that as enjoyable as it felt, that something was wrong. And I don't know, I had a desire to quit, but at the same time, I had this desire for this thrill that presented itself with getting high. And by the time I was 13, I was drinking liquor. I had my first car wreck when I was 13, my little first experience with drunk driving when I was 13. I was, smoking pot by the time I was 17. I was using a number of hallucinogenics. You know, Native people, we really get into hallucinogenics. That's, we equate that with the spiritual experience. There's nothing like swallowing peyote buttons and then throwing your guts up, you know, before you get off. I mean, and then laying in a ditch unable to move for a couple of days. I mean, that's a real spiritual experience. But there was a lot of justification, you know, as I went along. It was like, as long as I drink beer and I don't drink liquor, you know, as long as I don't drink liquor and I don't do barbiturates, as long as I do barbiturates and I don't do amphetamines, you know, I don't have a problem. As long as I don't do, the hallucinogenics, because that's what the hippies do, the real drug addicts, you know. That was during a time when I wore elephant-eared pants, if you remember those, and the psychedelic colors, with two-tone patent leather 3-inch stacks. I was a cool dude. Y'all had that workshop about the cool dude? I wish I'd have been there. And as long as I didn't do this, I thought I was okay. And then it comes to a point of like, as long as I don't do heroin, you know, that's what a real drug addict is, a heroin user. And then I done some junk, you know. The person who I used with made it okay. They said, well, let's not look at it this way. What we're shooting is PCP, and the junk is just to take the edge off of it. You know? It's a little Mexican brown base here. You know, and I mean, he was like a salesman telling me this, you know, it looked like a commercial while I was watching him, you know, and he was explaining it. And this happened to be my uncle, my mother's brother. I never let her forget that. So he had just got out of 5 years of prison. He'd built some time in the correctional, he built some time at State Penitentiary in Raleigh, North Carolina, his alma mater. And he was going to show me some of the things he'd learned while he was in school. So he gave me a shot, and the first shot I ever had was almost a hot shot. I guess it was a hot shot. It didn't kill me, but I thought I was dead there for a couple of days. And, the amazing thing about it is I said, well, as long as I don't do it again, then I don't have a problem, you know. But this program, for the first time, blew away all the reservation for me, you know. And today I know that I'm powerless, that I cannot use successfully. And my life's unmanageable. Hell, I've had 15 car wrecks, never could hold down a job, had broken relationships along the way. When I come into this program, I was involved in a very good marriage when I got here. You know, not mine, someone else's. It was an open marriage. One that I tried to close. I loved her and she loved him. I'll never forget that experience of riding down the road. He's driving, puts his hand on her knee and she puts hers on mine. You know, I'm looking to the right wondering where the hell my hand's going to go. But today I know I'm powerless. And what I'm powerless over is not just the drug. It's the disease. It's the disease of addiction, you know. Today, the requirement for using, the only requirement for this fellowship for me is the desire to stop using. Now, you know, and I feel like a spiritual part of this program is when I looked at that and I said, why didn't they put drugs on the end of it, you know? And then I thought, well, maybe it's because it's a desire to stop using people, places, things, anything for instant gratification to fix me outside this program. Excuse me, I'm almost about ready to cry here. But today in recovery, I know that first fix, pill, drink, snort, toke, or opium and Belladonna suppository some people's arms itch if you talk about drugs. The day before I came into this program, I hit a bottom. Tonight, I know that there's always another one out there. Tonight I know that recovery has to be in all areas of my life. And tonight I know that I can hit a clean bottom. You know, we hear people talk about the using bottom, but wait till you've hit a clean one. That's when you really doubt your sanity. Yeah. My sponsor once told me, he said, the steps are here for a purpose. They're here to be worked. If you don't work them, then you learn how to become a more efficient maniac. And indeed, there have been times when I've experienced that in recovery, thinking how to do more devious things, thinking how I could get away with things that I never got away with when I was getting high. And today I know that if I don't work them steps, that's what I go back to. We talk a lot about the insanity, being restored to sanity. I believe what the book says, that insanity is repeating the same mistakes over and over again, expecting different results. I looked for all types of cures before I got here. You know, the place I looked first was an educational cure. I went back to school. I went into the nursing program, being a good addict. I was the only male in class of about 40 women. They all protected me, looked out for me. We used to go out to lunch, get high, come back to class, and I'd nod out in anatomy and physiology. And they would kind of, you know, they'd make excuses for me. I also look for it in the religious cure. I have nothing against religion. You know, the reading says regardless of or religion or even lack of religion, you know. And I know today that I have to have this program regardless of anything else I may incorporate in my life. Because when I'm looking at religion, I didn't look for spirituality. I looked for what I could get from those people as well, you know. I used to stand up in church, stoned to the bone after smoking a few joints. and say some of the, what I thought were the most beautiful things you'd ever heard. Yeah. Go home, think about it, cry, because the words had touched me again. Yeah. Today I don't have to do that. But it's that insanity that I practiced that there is what brought me in here the day before coming in the program. I'd hit the bottom that prepared me for the program, got down on my knees, asked God, as I'm saying, God, to help me. And for the first time in my life, I said, God, I don't know who you are, what you are, where you come from, how much or how little you've done, and you know, what your connections are. But only in what you can do for me and how I can help. For the first time in my life, God was not something to analyze, to put under a microscope, to break down into its smallest component. You know, I used to go wild when I was high. I used to think these weird things about, well, if God created me, who created God? You know, that kind of thing. I could never figure that out. And that day before coming into the program, I realized for the first time I didn't have to figure it out. You know, it began to be a matter of just reaching out and looking for something outside of self to help me, you know. And today, that God that I turned to the day prior to coming into this program is the same God that works in my life and has kept me clean. When I got through praying, I got scared. I thought, what am I going to do? I'm going to tie myself up, put myself in the back room. You know, how am I going to make it? And the following day, God sent somebody into my life, and it was someone I used to use with on the weekends. He was a vet. He'd been to Vietnam, but he had somehow become confused in what he'd actually experienced, and a lot of the experiences he shared with me were experiences of other people that he relived, you know. We used to get high together on the weekend. We used to have pity parties. Damn, they were fun. I mean, you know, I mean, in active addiction, they were a lot of fun. We used to cry a lot. We used to hug. We used to do an A-frame hug. You know, when you get loaded and you can't stand up, so you just kind of lean into each other, you know. And we would wrap we'd wrap around each other, and we'd just kind of slowly slide to the floor. And we'd talk to each other about how pitiful we were, you know. And he'd say, you know, I just can't get over how bad it is that you can't see your son. I said, yeah, that's bad, isn't it? I said, I can't get over how you can't see your daughter, you know. And he said, yeah, that's bad, isn't it, you know. We'd get high for that weekend, I'd go home, then I'd come back. We'd do it all over again. And here this man was standing in my house inviting me to my first meeting. And the reason he came was I'd went to the neighbors. Well, I'd called the police on the last two people I used with. My uncle and my brother. God knows it was their fault. They were to blame. You know, they were drug addicts. I had it with them. I wanted them kicked out of the house. So I called the police, told the police, said, you kick these people out of my house, they're a bad influence on me. Hell, most of the shit they're using, they got from me. So this guy, this vet, he invited me to my first meeting. He said, you know, I told him about what happened. He said, I'm going to a meeting tonight. This was the following day after I'd said the prayer. Within 24 hours, looking back, I feel like within 24 hours, God answered my prayer. And he said, I'm going to this meeting, and he said, it's called Narcotics Anonymous. You know, and I, like so many people in this program, you know, narcotics sounded real loud. The anonymous, I couldn't hardly hear it. You know. I had a guy in the program say one time, said, "Well, you know, I feel like addicts have an amplified nervous system. You say five and they hear 10, you know, and what they react to is a 10, you know, and that's the way I was when I come into the program. And I thought, damn, all right, I'm ready to go. I wasn't sure. I thought we was going to go maybe see a few films, watch a video. You know, they was going to break down the pharmaceutical components of whatever it was that was blowing these people away. I got in the car. He put me in the car between him and this other guy, and we rode to my first meeting. Now, if I stick out my arm out here too far, I realize that's not... Okay. Let's forget that. Anyways, we went to my first meeting. Okay. Showing you how God, as I understand God, works in my life, this was the first meeting I found out after the meeting was over with of Narcotics Anonymous, as we know it today in the Carolina region. Yeah. I got clean at that meeting. And I'm still clean today, over 12 years later. We got to that first meeting, and I was back in the library with this guy. I was standing back to back to him, didn't know he was standing there, and I turned around, and we were nose to nose. You know, I mean, if I'd been looking for a relationship, I'd been right in the middle of one before I knew what happened. This was a guy I'd not seen in about 7 or 8 years, and he was a minister, and we used to get loaded together. Saved a lot of people that way. And he said to me at the same time that I said to him, we were nose to nose, and he said, I thought you were dead. You know, isn't it amazing? You know, out there, it's like, that's a normal damn statement. And coming to my first meeting, it sounded normal to me. I said, hell, I thought you were dead. You know, well, we said the same thing, exact same time. And I was kind of paranoid because he was there. I didn't, you know. I said, what are you doing here? Yeah, real appropriate question. He said, I've been clean 90 days in this other fellowship. I'm over here to find out what this one's about. I said, okay, well, I'll just stay too then. We sat in a meeting. They talked about the subject topic was God as you understand God. And I thought, my God, you know. They told me I was going to mental health, you know, and that's where the meeting was at. And I was familiar. I was okay with mental health. You know, I loved mental health. Mental health was home away from home, you know. You know. I had won friends and influenced others at mental health. You know? They cared for me at mental health. Told me they did. Showed me where to go to the bathroom when I need to go. I'd stayed a little while at mental health. And the other end, well, they lock you up and give you a room, you know. Stayed over there for a week. So I thought, this is great. We're going to mental health, you know. Mental health, the place where they told me I was depressed. I mean, hell, if you ain't had a bath in a damn month and you start, you know, I mean, of course you're depressed. If you can't get drugs, who wouldn't be depressed? Mental health, you say, you're depressed. We need to give you medication. You know? And I thought, this is great. You know? A chemical solution to my living problems. You know? So here I was at mental health, and it didn't look like a mental health meeting. You know, they were all sitting around in a circle like drug addicts. I could relate to that. You know, we used to sit in these circles, look at each other, kind of paranoid. They were doing the same thing at that first meeting. Nobody really knew what NA was all about. And here the subject topic was, God as you understand God. You know? I thought, yeah. Yeah, I know what this is. It might be mental health, but I've been down this route. And I knew when they start talking about God what's coming up, you know. So they went around the room and they shared. And I would hear them talking and it would make me paranoid as hell because it sounded like they were calling me by name when they were talking. One guy said, I just got out of detox. And I thought, that son of a bitch knows my name's D, and I... and I knew, whether he knows me or not, he put two E's on it. And the other guy said, I've been suffering from denial. And then as it went on around the room, another guy, he talked about God desiring to stand God in reference to himself, and he talked about being a degenerate. And I thought, this is going to be my sponsor for relationships right here, you know. They got around to me. I didn't want to talk. I had that knots in my throat and blood pressure beating my temples. And I said, I don't know if I believe in God or not. I was scared. I was afraid. The walls came up. But after the meeting was over with, after they got through talking, they made announcements and they passed the basket. And I said, by God, I told you. First we talk about God and then we pass the basket. Mm-hmm. I got them now. Yes, sirree. Yep. Pentecostal mental health. They gave out the chips. I was scared to death. I thought you had to pay for them. I wasn't sure. I thought maybe you're signing a blood oath or something. That's what I felt like if you picked up a chip. And I thought, no. They gave the chips out, and after they're over with, a little something tugged inside of me, because during the meeting they'd read something that says, the format used to be a little bit different. It said, this program of total absence from all drugs, and it goes on to say, including the drug alcohol, which is the oldest known drug to man. Even at that first meeting, I had a little reserve about drinking. I said, my God, you mean you want me to stop? I come here to get off of drugs. I ain't come here to quit drinking beer. But they'd read that and began to sink in, and I'd heard something else, and it just seemed like it jumped out. The addict didn't jump out, but there were two words, and it said, addictive personality. And I thought, that's me. Hell, that's my middle name. I can relate to this. I could relate to people talking about having an obsessive compulsive personality. So I picked up white chip. When I walked up and the guy presented it to me, he said, it was the guy that I was nose-to-nose with in the back room. And he said, we're going to have a couple people witnesses. Hell, I didn't know the difference. I mean, he called two people from the meeting up and said, stand here while I present him his chip. And they did. And he gave me the chip. I took the chip home with me. And when I left, I said, where are we going to a meeting tomorrow night? And they said, well, there is no meeting tomorrow night unless you want to go to Atlanta. And I said, well, let's go to Atlanta. I've been to Atlanta. I've got friends in Atlanta. And they said, well, we're not going to see those friends. But some of the people in the early days, Atlanta started 5 years before we did, and they invited us down. We loaded an entire group up, and we went to Atlanta and spent a weekend at one of them's house. And this was at 30 days clean. I swear to God, as I understand God, that it was one of the most beautiful experiences I've ever experienced. We got there and we had one meeting right after another in the house, and we talked about recovery all day long. We went over to a clubhouse and they had meeting after meeting. I'd never experienced meeting after meeting. I come from a place where, for hundreds of miles there was no other meeting except that one Monday night per week. I mean, you'd had to gone up into Virginia or down to Atlanta, or you'd had, at that time, I think 6 or 8 months later, NA started in Knoxville. At that time, you'd had gone beyond Knoxville out toward Memphis. So it was a pretty large geographical area. But we made meetings one right after the other the entire weekend, and I've had using dreams before, but when I went to sleep that Saturday night and I woke up the following Sunday morning, I woke up saying, dreaming that I was in a meeting, and I woke up saying, my name's Dee and I'm an addict. And when I woke up, that 1 second between being asleep and being awake was the most beautiful moment, one of the most beautiful moments I think I've ever felt in this program. And the tears came to my eyes as we said goodbye, and I didn't want to go home. And I told them, I said, I don't want to go home. I want to stay here. There's a lot more meetings here. And they said, well, if you'll come back home, you can help start some more meetings up there. And when we do, we'll grow as well, and we'll have the recovery back home, that they have here. The way I learned about God as I understand God in this program was once sitting in a meeting, there was a physician who had a recovering doctor, believe it or not, who was sitting in the meeting. I mean, everyone else had shared. I mean, they were debating as to whether or not God actually existed. You know, I mean, I could hear that in the meeting. So we're going around and around being so analytical about God as we understand God in this program. You know, and this guy sat real quiet. And toward the end of the meeting, he said, you know what? He said, I cannot prove to you beyond a shadow of doubt that God does or does not exist. But I believe in God simply because I benefit from that belief. That's been the rock that I've stood on ever since as far as my relationship with God as I understand God. And when hard times hit and the doubts began to set in, I think back about what that doctor said that night in that meeting. And when I do, it's almost like I get goosebumps thinking about it. And I know that something out there is standing by me now in recovery, something that I was never able to utilize while I was getting loaded, and something that will always be there for me as long as I choose to have it there for me. I was one of those... I know nobody's experienced this. I was one of those 90-day wonders, you know. At 90 days, I was wondering what in the hell I was doing, you know. Like, I'd gone through it at 30 days, and it was pretty scary. I picked up a chip down there at that clubhouse we were at. For the first time ever, I'd walk through the door, and a man come rushing up, this huge guy covered with leather, you know, this biker person, you know what I'm saying? Had real long hair, and he rushed me in. I mean, he rushed me fast, too. Picked me up off the ground, swung me around and around, set me back down on the floor, and said, "I love you." I looked at him and I said, "I bet you do." See, we didn't do a lot of the hugging back home. We done a little bit, but I mean, that guy, he's the guy that broke it in for me as far as relationship. I mean, being able to touch other men in the program. That happened at 30 days clean. And then he introduced himself and he said, "My name's Motorcycle Ed and I'm an addict." But in 90 days, I played the game of ketchup. It wasn't hot sauce, it was ketchup. And through competition and comparison and watching you at the meetings, I decided that you had more than I did, and it was time for me to catch up. You know? Yeah. And they told me, "If you want something, pray for it." And I said, "Well, by God, I will." You know? And I told... probably the tooth fairy as well as God as I understand God. "I want a new house. I want a new house. I want a house. I want a job. I want a relationship. And I want two children, a male and female, ages 6 and 8. I was one of those people who prayed for patience right now. You know what I mean? And if you don't give it to me, it's going to piss me off. I learned how to pay a light bill after I got into this program. I had so many people out there who was kissing my ass and carrying my ass and babying me and treating me as the mentally ill person I wanted to be that I didn't know how to do nothing when I got here. And now I want everything, and I wanted to catch up, and I was 90 days clean. I went out and applied for a job. Next day, the phone rang. I got up. I didn't want to answer it at first. Then I got up and I answered it, and they said, "Would you like to come to work?" And I thought, "Hey, wait a minute, God. You know, I prayed for this, but, you know, give me a few days to think about the job part. I'd rather have the house and the old lady first, you know." And I went to work. I took the job. I was working 8 hours a day to begin with. I thought, how in the hell can somebody work 8 hours a day? You know? And they wouldn't let me go home when I wanted to. And then I thought, well, if eight's fine, but I'll do 10. You know, being the obsessive compulsive person I am. And then I'll work 12-hour days. Now I'll work 16. And I was becoming that more efficient maniac. And I was walking home one day. And as I was walking home, I told God, as I understand God about it, I said, I was walking along, I was trying to get a ride. Cars would pass me. And I mean, I looked rough. I mean, I have nothing against long hair. I had long hair, you know, halfway down my back. But I had a look on my face that kind of went with everything else, you know. And it was coming by, and every time it'd come by, I'd get pissed. I'd be hitchhiking. I'd say, damn you, stop! What's the matter with you? Don't you realize I'm in recovery? No. I'm clean now. I go to meetings. I've got a conscious contact. I've got serenity. God damn it, stop. Isn't it amazing how even standing out in the road they'll go around you? I mean, it was a little hard for me to get the message. It was raining, and I hadn't done a rain dance. And I told God, as I understand God, if I had a beer right now, I'd drink it. I was walking along. I was walking down the sidewalk. I looked down. There was an empty carton of beer bottles, with the exception of one. And the cap was still on it. Sometimes I believe that God, as I understand God, answers prayers not because I need it, but because I want it in order to show me that I don't need it. See, I'm hard-headed as hell. I know y'all can't relate to that. I mean, I'll bump my head against the wall over and over and over and over again and then swear up and down that I don't have the slightest idea what insanity's all about. You know. And it's very easy to talk about the insanity that comes out there. You know, I used to sit in meetings and talk about all that sick shit that I done out there, you know. Recovery for me today is being able to talk about and deal with all the insanity that I practice here. After looking down at that beer, I looked up and I said, no thanks, God, not today. And I ran home. Got on the phone, called my sponsor. I was scared shitless. Hell, I was shaking. I said, you know, I told him what happened. Told him about God offering me a beer. He said, well, did you drink it? I said, no. He said, well, get your ass to a meeting. He cut back on my work hours. People here have carried me when I couldn't carry myself. People have been here for me when I needed someone to be here for me. It bothers me when I come to meetings and I hear people say, let them work their own program. I'm just here to work my own program. Hell, if I'm on a ship and somebody's drowning, do you think I'm going to wait till they go down to the third time to say, hey, wait a minute, do you want me to throw you something? Hell no, I don't do that. If I love someone and I care about them in this program and I see that insanity, I feel obligated to tell them about it. Lives don't get saved by people remaining quiet. as time went on, I also at about 90 days, I done something else very foolish. I started a fourth step. And I had decided that I should be slim and trim in time to get this new house and car and wife and children. I had been fasting for 14 days when I done a fourth step. I was so hungry I could have ate the ass off of a horse at a full gallop. And that's with me doing the galloping. I talked to someone in the program. I said, what do you write when you write a four-step? He said, write the first thing that comes to mind. And I wrote, I hate the world. I was wearing glasses. I threw them off. I broke them, got up, kicked them across the room, stomped them. Didn't wear glasses for many years after that in this program, just to remind me of the insanity of that moment. Ran everybody out of the house. I thought it was a sacred moment, starting the fourth step. I said, I don't want nobody in the house. I'm writing a fourth step. They wouldn't leave, so I pulled a butcher knife. They had a spiritual awakening. They ran next door. Called me up on the phone from next door. Said, are you finished with your four step yet? I was aggravated and frustrated. I decided it was time to end it all, time for another little self-pity party, and I was going to kill myself. I jerked a vacuum cleaner cord out. Threw it over the door to the kitchen, slammed the door shut on the cord, pushed the chair up next to the door, climbed up into the chair, decided that willingness to go to any length meant tying your hands behind your back before you put the cord over your head. And that's exactly what I done. The problem with that was I kept butting my head against the door, trying to get the vibrations to flip the cord over my head. My sister was in the back bedroom, calm as hell, writing a letter to her boyfriend. Really freaked me out not getting a reaction from her. My sister's name is Pam, and I said, Pam. She said, what? I said, come here a minute. She said, what for? I said, I want you to put this cord over my head. My sister, with all the love and concern of someone who's involved in a truly fucked up family, said, fuck you. You don't have to be from a reservation to understand that one. you even done it in sign language. And after she used the two most beautiful words I'd ever heard, I said, "This is great. This is, you know, I got a response. I can't believe it. It's like she understands, you know, she loves me. She doesn't want me to kill myself." And then my sister ruined it by saying, "They're not sending me to prison for murder." Somehow I have a feeling that she'll never serve a sentence for anything like that. She is so detached from things, it's unreal. You know? Well, they call again. This time they said, "Where's your sister at?" I said, "My sister's tied up." Which she was. She was washing the dishes. They didn't take it that way. I mean, to them, the ties that bind meant something else, if you know what I mean. They called the police. Told them once again the nut had flipped out. Sent them to the house. About two or three cars pulled up out front. Scared the absolute shit plumb out of me. Thought, "Wow, this is great. I'm going to learn how to go to jail clean." I ran out the back door, barefooted, into the snow. They come up, circled the house, saw the Bigfoot tracks, come around to the front and knocked on the door. When my sister answered the door, they said, "Is this a joke?" She said, "No, this is life as we know it." I stayed out in the woods long enough to get frostbite. I come up by my neighbor's house, the other guy that I'd rode with to my first meeting, the one who had told the vet about seeing the police at my house the day before, and that's how it came about that this guy came and invited me to my first meeting. I walked by his house now, and I crouched down to go by the windows hoping he wouldn't see me, you know, because I didn't want anyone else in the program to see me. And I crawled into the house. Ended up going to the doctor for frostbite. Mother had talked to the judge. The judge had decided that I needed to go to mental health. Home away from home. So I could see my friends again. They set up a meeting and I had to go. You know, and I sat there and there was three shrinks sitting in front of me. I felt like I was about to shrink the way they were looking at me. And they said, "What happened?" I said, "I'll tell you what happened. I forgot to do what the people in Narcotics Anonymous told me to do." You know, they said H-A-L-T, and I didn't listen. You know, they told me one day at a time, and I didn't listen. You know, they told me to listen in a meeting. They told me to listen to my sponsor, and I didn't do it. I know what's wrong. I need to do what the people of NA tell me. You know, I got up and I walked out of that room and never looked back. And I've never had to go through the doors of mental health again, not as a patient. And that's what this program has given me. For those of you who sometimes feel like there's no hope, I'll tell you about that first step. Yeah, I'm powerless over my addiction. My life's unmanageable. But today I know that doesn't mean, unmanageability does not mean hopeless, and it does not mean helpless. You know? That if that first step pointed out that my life's unmanageable, that I got 11 other steps to obtain a certain degree of manageability. And to me, that's what NA is about today. Yeah. It's about going to work. It's about doing the footwork to do the things that I prayed about early in recovery. And all those things have come true to me. No, not to any great degree. You know, I have a lot of bills. I don't have a new car or a new house or anything else, but I have the two things that have kept me coming back to a certain degree. I have them, and that's peace of mind and serenity. And you know, I looked for that in a lot of places prior to getting here. I looked for it in a lot of faces, a lot of places, a lot of drugs, and never found it. That's something I found after I got here. But when I went back, I began to sit down and do the four step the way it was meant to be done. You know, I'd ride a little bit and it'd get to hurting and I'd put it down. I'd pick it up later on. And I could remember what actually happened and what did. I could remember if it, you know, I didn't know if some things were true or not, because my mother and my family members had told me some things, and they'd told me so many times that I think I somehow began to believe them and incorporate them. And it was a real investigative process for me to go back and to try to look at it honestly and objectively and do it right. And for me, and this is how I work my program, I went back and looked at some of the places that some of the things happened in my life. And some of it began to break loose, and I began to remember some things. But it took going back to do it. I didn't go into any bars. I didn't go to no dope houses or present any. And one thing I believe in this program, it's the necessity of changing playgrounds and playmates. You know? And I spent, contrary to what some other people believe in my area, I some people in my area seem to think that it should be done in less time, but I spent about 18 months, I guess, writing. Writing a little bit, putting it down, sometimes for days, sometimes for even weeks, picking it back up and writing again. And I began the very slow, but not quite so tedious process of doing the four step. And then I began to look for a fifth step person. And like a lot of people in this program, I done it with my sponsor. I thought, hell, you know, if he tells anything, I'll fire his ass, you know. We got in the car and went through about three states, me doing it, and I'd say something, he'd say, I've done that. I'd say something else, and he'd say, I've done that. And then I'd say something else, and he'd say, oh, I've done that. And finally, I looked over and I said, is there any goddamn thing that you haven't done that I have? You know, I mean, I felt like I was competing with him or something, you know. But, well, let me tell you about this. I bet you haven't done this, you know. I mean, it was a wild experience, but it was, you know what I found out from that experience? I'm not unique. I'm not different. You know, I haven't really done anything that y'all haven't done 100 times before. That's why you're worse than I am. No. And I hear people, you know, I've shared other people's, I've been a fifth step person, quote unquote, or whatever you want to call it, and sit in, listen to other people's fifth step, and I don't know. I've found from experience there's two things that people are kind of reluctant to talk about. One are the legal things that they don't like, you know. And I tell people, you don't have to name it, you know. You don't have to give a time and a date and a person, you know. And the other are the sexual. These were also the two categories that were hardest for me to deal with when I done a fifth step, you know. But I also shared about some other things with this in this fifth step, and I'll share them with you because they're not really all that personal. As a matter of fact, I think someone in here can probably relate to it. My father died from active addiction. He died when I was 14 years old. I went to Lorain, Ohio to stand by his bed the last 3 days of his life. My father was, he was Indian and Irish. He was very macho. He was a person who did not like to share his feelings. And I stood 3 days by my father's bed as he was dying, when his head, as big as a pumpkin, with that jaundiced look, you know, waiting for my father to say the three words that I wanted to hear most. I love you. And you know, my father didn't say that. He couldn't bring himself to say it. And as I watched the life leave my father's body, I felt like there was a hole beginning to open up in me. And today in my recovery, I try to the best of my ability to tell other people that I love them, that I care about them, and try not to take them for granted. I shared that when I'd done a fifth step, and my sponsor had had a similar experience happen to him. And I hear people talk about being happy, joyous, and free when they just get through doing a fifth step, and they come out of the room, and it's like, oh, I'm on cloud nine. You know, this is great. This is wonderful. Hell, I didn't. I felt bad. When I got through dumping all that shit, I mean, I talked about the good as well as the bad, but when I got through with it, I was not jumping for joy. And I could not understand why, because others had told me what I was supposed to feel. I guess it took 2 or 3 weeks later as the healing process began, and I began to feel that a burden had somehow began to be lifted. You know? And I shared also with this fifth step person about the death of my stepfather. See, my mother wasn't satisfied with marrying one addict. She went out and married another one. We know that's uncommon. And when talking about my character defects, my stepfather comes to mind. Because my stepfather had sunk to the depth of being a street person. Not that I'm judgmental about street people, but his addiction had taken him really low. And he would do anything and everything to support his habit. And I hated him. I hated him with every fiber of my being. My mother married him when I was 11 years of age. And last time I saw him alive was when I had a gun in his face and I was 17 years old. I'd calculated killing him. As a child, I calculated killing him. I remember being 12 and 13 and hiding in the bushes with a gas can full of gas, waiting for him to come in the house, and I was going to splash it on him and set him on fire. The insanity of the addict affects the sanity of the family member. I know that today. But I became very insane as a child as a result of being exposed to other people's addictions. I shared in this with my fifth step person. I also shared about his death and how after I had been clean a year and 2 days, I got in the mail a little clipping stating that my stepfather had been in Knoxville, Tennessee at a flop house, a mission, whatever. He'd come off the chain gang. They'd kicked him out about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and he'd come outside and he'd went around the corner to crawl in a dipsy dumpster full of rags in order to stay warm. After he crawled into that dumpster, a dump truck come along, picked him up, and compacted him. The physician said that it took at least 3 to 5 minutes for him to die because there was nothing in there to really mash him up. It was just rags and stuff. So I guess he stayed in there immobile for 3 to 5 minutes until he finally suffocated. After being clean a little over a year, I had a lot of guilt when I heard about this. And in my mind, I kept saying, I wonder if there was anything I could have done. I wonder if there was anything that I could have done. And why now, after I'm clean, is he dead? You know? And I truly believe today, I believe that this disease is fatal and that some are going to pay the price. Today, I don't fully understand why I'm standing up here alive. By all rights, I shouldn't be. I've had guns go off in my face. I've been cut. I've been hit by cars. I've had a lot of things happen. But I'm grateful today, and I believe that I'm alive today for a reason. I believe a part of that's to carry the message. I also believe that's part of the reason you're alive, is to carry the message, among other things, to be a part of this program, to come to meetings. But the character defect that I had to work on most was the rage, the hate, the resentment that I felt, especially in reference to my stepfather. And it took working through that. You know, for 10 years after my stepfather died, I could not go to his gravesite. And then finally, one day I went, and I knew I couldn't take it no longer. I called my mother up, and I said, I got to go. You know, I got to go. Prior to his death, I was so angry, I said, you know what, one of these days you're going to die. If I don't kill you, someone else will, and when they do, I'm going to piss on your grave. I mean, that's how I felt at that time. In recovery, when I called my mother up and we went to his gravesite and stood beside his grave, I began to feel a healing process in that relationship. And I made my amends at graveside. I hear a lot of people talk about making amends, and they say, I put my name at the top of the amends list. I didn't. I make amends to myself every day I come to this fellowship. The people that I put on the top of my amends list was my immediate family because they were the easiest to reach. I was lazy. I was a procrastinator. Who in the hell wanted to take the energy to go out on the street to fuck somebody up, right? I mean, when you had a ready, available victim, I mean, you know. Especially when you know they'll take it over and over again and keep coming back for more. So I went to my mother. I made amends to my mother. As a matter of fact, my mother's one of the first I made amends to, and my mother looked at me. You know, the biggest change, I mean, one of the things that touched me most since being in this program is I come in the house one day after going to a meeting, as I was walking through, my mother looked at me and she said, you know what? You've changed. You've changed. And it touched me, and it touched me deeply because you in here know what takes place in that process. She does not. But my mother could see the end result of what you've done for me. You know, early in recovery, my mother, let me tell you, my mother don't like for me to tell this, but early in recovery, I used to walk the floor the first 90 days when I come home from me. I would walk the floor. I mean, I don't know if it was prolonged withdrawal. See, when I come straight into this fellowship, I'd never been to nothing before. No prior fellowship, no detox, no halfway house, no treatment center, no nothing. I knew nothing about none of these things prior to coming into the fellowship. And I used to walk the damn floor day and night after a meeting, waiting for that next meeting. I'd come home, I'd be paranoid. You know, people talk about damn cocaine psychosis. Piss on it. 90-day psychosis is a bitch. You know? I'd run, look out the window, peek, see if somebody pulled up, and I just wore place and around the table in the living room. And my mother, she'd get all upset and been out of shape, and she said, "Oh," she said, "what's the matter with you?" And I said, "I don't know, I don't know." She said, "I know what's the matter with you. It's going to those damn meetings. It's those people in those meetings. They've got you upset." You know? And she'd follow me around and around with a nerve pill in her hand, saying, she'd say, "You need a nerve pill." I'd say, "No, they told me at the meeting not to take a nerve pill." And she'd say, "I don't care what they told you at the meeting. This is medicine." My mother was my best physician when I was using. She gave me a lot of medicine. She said it would help calm me down. I'll tell you what, I've been so damn calm from my mother's medication I couldn't move. My biggest prayer sitting in the chair trying to get up was, "Please, God, let me breathe one more time." So when my mother had reached the point to where she could notice the change, I noticed that there had been a change in her. See, we've grown. She and I, mother and I. And it's through this program. Even the fallout from this program lands on some people. Did you know that? And I believe today in that maintenance, we, you know, the speaker last night was talking about 10th step. And I'll tell you what, I think that's something I have to be careful about because I sometimes procrastinate. But if I'll get off my ass and admit it when I'm wrong, I've grown. And sometimes, especially early in recovery, and it may happen again tomorrow, hell, who knows. But I'd go through these periods and I'd say, oh, God damn it, just ain't no sense in staying clean. I can't take it, you know. And my sponsor said, you know what? When it seems like there's no reason in the world to stay clean, and you stay clean anyways, you've grown. He said that to me when I got in relationships. I was like, 2 years in this program, I got involved with a woman who's 2 years in this program. You know, we lived together for 8 months. Can you imagine two people in this program living together for 8 months? Some of you have done it. We used to go to meetings together. See, we didn't trust each other. We'd go to meetings and we'd take everybody's inventory. We'd come home after the meeting and sit and look at each other and we'd pass judgment. We'd say, yep, yeah, he was bullshitting. Yeah, we know she's screwing that newcomer. He says he's lonely, but we know what he's wanting. We woke up at 3 o'clock one morning and she wanted to do a fifth step with me. She said, I've got something to tell you. And I said, what? I said, wait a minute. I don't think you ought to be telling me. I think you better tell your sponsor. She said, no, it's important. It's important. Yeah. She told me. I said, now, go back to sleep. She did. What I've learned in relationships, especially when it comes to working the steps, and there's only 12, and it's on an individual basis. Today, I don't work 24. You know, I used to try to work 24. 12 for her, 12 for me, and it don't work that way. But I was caught. Sometimes it was like I felt like I was in a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation, you know. Yeah. If I listen to her, and I'm upset, then I don't care. I'm insensitive, you know. I can't talk about relationships. If I listen to her, I'm damned, and if I don't, I'm damned. Because either way, never mind, something came to mind here. I'm going to let this go. Today I'm going to turn that one over. But you know, I hear a lot of people talk about sick relationships. It must have been a bunch of them here because the committee brought in Blue Cross Blue Shield. But I'll tell you about those quote-unquote sick relationships. You make them through them clean, and you don't use over them, you've grown. I've had guys, our sponsor, come to me and they'll say, I want to get involved in a relationship. I said, okay, I'm here. And they say, not you. We're not talking about you. We're talking about this little girl we met in the meeting. Yeah. And then they try to justify it. We just want to be friends. I said, all right, it don't do me a damn good. I'm not going to try to tell you to abstain for any year or whatever. It ain't going to do no damn bit of good. I want you to get involved. You know. Because if you're not working the steps now, when you get involved in that relationship, in order to stay clean, by God, you'll be working them. The 11th step talks about salt through prayer and meditation, and today I feel like recovery for me is in the seeking. The growth is in the seeking. You know, and I'm constantly seeking. It's when I think that I've reached that destination that I know all there is to know about that relationship with God, as I understand God. And that's the primary relationship in my life today. That's numero uno. Nothing comes before that relationship. Nothing. Nothing. I haven't even been in a relationship like this almost 4 years because of putting forth the energy into that relationship. You know, and today I'm okay with that. And I'm not lonely at night playing old Elvis Presley records or whatever, you know. Or crying or freaking out or whatever else. I've been real secure in that relationship with God as I understand God. And today I'm trying to improve that conscious contact. And praying for His will instead of mine. And the power to carry that out. For a long time, I couldn't understand. I said, first you tell me I'm powerless, and then down here at number 11 you're saying I got some damn power. Power from somewhere. You know, what do you mean, you know? And today it's, you know, today it's, to the best of my ability, I just try to turn it over and whatever happens, happens. I heard a guy say in a meeting one time, he said, hell, I could throw a ball up in the air, and when it come down, whoever hit it first could probably handle my life better than I could. You know. And sometimes that's the way I feel. And today, if I can just handle it as it comes and make it through it without flipping out, I feel like I've got something from this fellowship. You know. And a lot of the growth for me is in carrying the message. We talk about that. You know, when I got 12 step, we talk about having had, you know, a spiritual awakening. You know. And I got real analytical again. I asked my sponsor, and this is what he told me. He said, a spiritual awakening, as far as I'm concerned, is a profound personality change as a result of working the prior 11 steps. I thought it. I hate it. God damn it. When you make it so simple, I can understand it. You piss me off. And I believe that today. And that's my definition. That's what works for me. You know. And I believe in carrying the message. Just prior to coming in here to speak, I talked to someone outside. And they had tears in their eyes. And they said, you know, I just had a relapse. I didn't know this convention here. They were talking. They seen this T-shirt. That's what it was. I was standing out in front of the motel. And I saw the T-shirt. You know, I said, you know, I just got out of a detox and had tears in his eyes. And I said, you know, you're in the right place. Just keep coming back. We talk about spiritual experiences. I can't think of one more spiritual than going into a detox and holding the hand of somebody who's going through withdrawal and saying, God, as I understand, God loves you through this fellowship and works through its members. And if you'll just give it a chance, it'll work for you. That's where it's at for me. I hate it when I hear people say, I'm not getting anything out of this program. And they come to meetings and they never make a pot of coffee. They never empty an ashtray. They never set out a chair. They never chair a meeting. And they're bored. They never go to a detox, halfway house, a prison. When the meeting's over, they don't talk to the newcomer. They're too busy standing over in the corner talking to their friends they've known for years about going out to Denny's and having a cup of coffee. You know, and that's not where it's at for me. And when I do that, I get away from what I feel like this program's all about. Because I feel like it's important to reach out to that newcomer. You know, where I come from, you're an old-timer at 30 days. I hear people sit in meetings and say, yeah, you newcomers, you know. I hate the term old-timer. I'm not an old-timer. You know, I too am a newcomer. If each day is a new beginning and today is all we have, then by God, I'm a newcomer too, and I'm just as much a lifeblood of this program as anybody here. And when I get away from that, it's when I get in trouble. Before I close, I'd just like to say one little thing that's very important to me or whatever, also about carrying the message, you know. When I go into a meeting, I do not bring up a subject topic
with the utmost urgency, and then after I bring up the subject topic, get up and walk out of the room. I do not carry on crosstalk in the meeting and talk with some guy or girl sitting next to me during the meeting while somebody else is sharing. That's not what recovery is about for me today. I don't get up and fan the door and go in and out of a meeting five separate times while the meeting's going on, or stand in the back next to the coffee pot and carry on a conversation back there. Today, for me in recovery, that's not what NA is about. You know? I love you. I care about you. You know, I got two families. I got a family. I got a family that God gave me a long time ago. In that other life, when the other life began. But you know, I got a new family too, a newer family. A family in recovery that came when I got clean. And that's everybody sitting in this room. And I believe that God has put you in my life. You're my brother, my sister, my mother. You've been my father that I never had. You've been there for me. You've cared about me when I didn't care about myself. And for that, I'll keep coming back. And then in ending, I'd just like to say, recovery, the journey continues.